Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hulfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 5 of season 10. I've been using Boris FX products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with editors Jerome Brisson, ACE, and Daniel Martins about their Ace Eddie nomination for their episode, the finale, of Lessons in Chemistry. The series was also edited by Matthew Barbado, Laura Zempel, ACE, Jack Cunningham, and Lily Wild. Jerome was previously a guest on Art of the Cut to discuss Coda when it won the Oscar for Best Picture. His other projects include Camp X-Ray and the TV series Counterpart. He's currently editing the TV series Shogun. Daniel edited the feature Katie's Mom and episodes of the TV series Suits. He was an additional editor on the feature Captive and the TV series New Amsterdam. Before I hop into our discussion with Giroux and Daniel, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free, no limits, 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. A brief warning before we begin our interview, there will be a discussion of spoilers. And now, editors Jerome Brisson, ACE, and Daniel Martins discuss their Ace Eddie nomination for the finale of Lessons in Chemistry. The TV series is based on a book. Did you read the book?
I did not finish the book because the same thing happened to me about a year before. Actually, I was, and this is how I met Daniel, when I was hired to work on a TV, another TV series called Shantaram, which is also an adaptation of a very popular book. And I started reading it when I was hired. I went about 300 pages into it, and it's a pretty thick one. And I realized how confused I was getting from the way the book was structured and written, and the way Steve Lightfoot, who was the showrunner, was interpreting the book to give us the experience of the book. But basically, because it was such a huge journey, he had to adapt it in a way that it would work for a TV series. When I was hired on Lessons in Chemistry, I did start the book, and I realized that I was getting the same kind of problems. I was enjoying the book very much, but also my mind was going against possibly what Lee Eisenberg was trying to attempt.
I did not read the book, but when I told my mom when I was coming on the show, she freaked out. She had read it. All of her friends had read it. It's like, I never in my career or life have I started to work on something where it already had such a huge fan base. So that was a little intimidating, but also kind of cool, because it's like, you know, you're going to interpret a book, and then people will watch it and they'll have their experience of the book, and then they'll have the experience of the film, you know.
It's about 50-50. Like the people that I talk to that want to read the book feel like they have to read the book, and the ones that are like, no, absolutely, I wanted to be as far away from it as possible. I only want the material in my brain.
I mean, I was listening to Hilda Rizzo interview you did, and she also said she read the book after the fact for American Fiction. I think it depends on honestly how things progress sometimes. And in this case, what was happening when I started is Lee was still writing, I guess getting new pages, as a matter of fact. When he first sent me the script, he said, I'm writing this episode. I will give you 12 pages on Thursday and you'll get the rest this weekend, which I never happened to me before, but I had worked with Lee in the past. So I think maybe that he felt comfortable doing this with me, possibly for that reason. So knowing that and knowing how he was proceeding, I felt like I should be open to his read of the book. There are differences, clearly. I think it's out there, it's documented what the differences are. And we hope that we at least give the audience, we leave them with the same sentiment that the book was leaving the readers.
It sounds like you're saying that the structure of the book and the structure of the TV series is very different.
I don't think it was so much a structure that it was changes in characters. The character of Harriet was a different character in the book, for instance.
Well, it's so interesting you say that because my wife read the book before she saw the TV series, loved both of them, and said the TV series is really accurate to the book. It's obviously her feeling of the book and the TV series are the same more than the facts of of them. Very interesting. It was very interesting about that specifically. Montages always fascinate me. So tell me about when you're starting to create a montage like that, what are the choices and how do you go about the rhythm, especially is important in a montage.
Well, I'm glad you asked for this one because even though I'm credited on this episode, Daniel started this montage. Her directors, Bird and Birdie, on this episode had a very specific idea about using rhythm, using a jazz track, and punctuating every day as if the days repeat and the intensity of those days increases as it goes, using all those very rhythmic elements like the dog barking, the alarm clock, the rowing machine, all those things to create this passage of time. And it's she's chasing time to be able to hopefully finish her research before her pregnancy is over. So that was the goal of this.
Well, I had the direction of Elizabeth was pregnant and she was racing, almost racing against the clock, like Giroux was saying. Like, I think like the first cut of it was a lot more visceral because, like, how I cut it with the jazz music, and it was a lot more, I won't say violent, but it kind of built up in this sort of emotional violence to like release until we see that she's finally, we see how far she's come with the pregnancy. And then Giroux watched it a few times, and he was—I don't know if it was Bert and Bertie that had the note, or if it was you, Giroux, where you were like, "Oh, we should try and tie in the clock." Ticking of the clock was kind of a later addition. I mean, we had the alarm clock when she wakes up, but then we later tied it into Calvin's broken stopwatch. The hand is like moving, and then we cut to the clock on the wall, and it's just like passage of time and like not being able to finish what you started. And the frustration of that. That's kind of what I was going with that first pass. And then Giroux took it over and kind of, you know, tweaked it and made it awesome.
You said the direction of it. Is it something that you received in a conversation or a note before you started editing from the director, or was it strictly from the script or strictly from the dailies that you were watching?
For this specific sequence, actually, it was not very clear to me how to cut it at first. And only when Bird and Birdie came in the cutting rooms, they explained what they're like, how they had envisioned. It's true that the idea of the clock, the only element that was shot was the alarm clock for this sequence. When Daniel showed me the montage, which was in large part working already, what was not clear to me is that this idea that there was time passing and that she was chasing the clock ticking. She was racing that clock. We had the shot in this episode of the stopwatch. We had it when she created this pregnancy test. And then we borrowed the clock on the wall from episode 2.
So there was not elements that you had to ask to be shot, and it was not elements that were specifically shot for the montage.
They were also racing for time on set. So whatever I could ask for, it was very little chance that I would get.
I understand. I understand that. What about the scene, the choice to go from birth to 7 years later at lunch with who you think is her daughter?
That was scripted. All the way that we play with time in this episode was scripted, most of it. We adjusted once we had the episode together. There's always things that moves, but it was already in the DNA of the episode that we would have this misdirect, and they would play with, but our writers already thought playing about the idea of you think this is Elizabeth's daughter, but it reveals that it is not her. But tying it to the food, tying it to the hardship of growing up and things like that, all those ideas were already in the script.
And did you find that the timings also, when the transitions happened between 7 years later and, you know, the current time, did that work out exactly as scripted, or did you find that you wanted to adjust when you went between them for emotional reasons or other reasons?
Yeah, no, in this episode, especially the transition, some of them were tricky, and some of them we had to really pick. For instance, we wanted to carry emotion throughout the time. So the way we left it and the way we got into the next scene, we wanted to sort of make the outgoing emotion have it transpire into the next scene, you know, and carrying those things throughout. Elizabeth's struggle, the first month of being a mother, we wanted to suggest that there may be, you know, a connection between all those elements, between growing up and the struggle of raising a child and the struggle of school experience as well. We wanted to tie the mother and the daughter, also already make that bond pretty strong, regardless of what the bond was. So carrying those emotions from one timeline to the next, I think, was a key to making that bond.
Daniel, with any episodes that you cut, what's your philosophy? Do you cut them to the script, or do you realize that you need to change and you just change it from the beginning?
I cut to script, but I also use the script as a roadmap. Sometimes what they shot isn't really kind of what you're envisioning on the page. So you cut it as close as you can, at least for my own work. And then sometimes you're gonna find pieces that are missing or something that you need to kind of create to get from one point to the next.
It's an obligation to give a script as much of a chance as possible when we start. And doing so, there's ideas, obviously. I think even when we watch dailies, I sort of try to watch them with this empathetic way of seeing what all the possibility could be, knowing the script. And beyond is also, oh, what if? Is there other possibilities? But those possibilities, I think I keep in the back of my mind for the first part of the process, and first try to stay close to the intentions of the script. I wouldn't say that I'd make big changes, but sometimes if I have an idea of how things could be, I would do a second version and keep it and only start sharing those things by the time I start working with people. Or I would warn, oh, by the way, I tried something different there. We work with a group of people, director, writer, producers, even cinematographer, all the rest of the crew that is in production. They dream this project for a long time. They get to bring it to reality. They shoot, our actors, they perform those characters. When we receive all of this, it's almost like this dream is confronted to reality, and now we have to build it back into a dream that is for the audience to experience later on. I feel like we have to take the time and not skip the steps. And we have to embark on this journey with the people who dreamt it first. And that's important to build that connection with them. And then the script is that connection.
I've talked to a lot of people about editing episodic television, where an editor's on a show for multiple years, multiple seasons, episodes. Is it different working with directors on something that's a limited series where you know you got to work with the director and then you move on to the showrunner? Is it similar on a limited series?
My experience is that it was. Lee Eisenberg, I've worked with Lee on Little America. And on that show, him and Sean Heder were running the show together. This was actually Lee's first time, if you can believe that, because he has a lot of credit as a showrunner, but it was his first time doing it alone. He really stepped up into that position. He loved the book. He actually reached out to Apple at some point to see if he could do it. And he was already in the work at Apple. And in this case, I mean, he was really her guiding light throughout this series. And her director, you know, they stepped in and they brought so much to each episode. There's no doubt. It was always sort of that dynamic of we work with our directors for a certain amount of time, so usually limited. And then we're going to spend a much more time with the showrunner. But Lee also absolutely wants to keep the directors as involved as he can for the longest time. No matter what changes we made after our director turned in their cut, we were submitting them the cuts. And we, if they wanted, our director could absolutely chip in on what we were doing. And it was the same for Little America as well.
Daniel, can you talk about that process of working with a director creatively or politically, knowing those things might change to the showrunner?
On other shows that I've edited, it's like been deeper into the seasons, like season 5 or 6 or something like that, or even 8, where the machine is so well greased that like you don't, there's no real leeway to like do things differently. But then occasionally you'll get someone that will want to try something else. And sometimes their instincts are completely right. And sometimes it's like a little off and you have to kind of be like, yeah, we can try it. You know, it's their cut. You know, we can try it. But you can also give them a little warning that's like, you know, it might change. It's not really the showrunner's style or how they like to do things. But, you know, politically, you kind of have to do what the director wants. It's like their cut. But then also always keep in mind that the showrunner is going to want it a certain way. And just, you know, you can prepare yourself for things like that. You can do your version where it's closer to that. I mean, when you're deep into a season, your editor's cut usually kind of tackles that. It'll always sometimes always just go back to the editor's cut, you know, like that happens quite often.
Yeah, there's a lot to gain from listening and and then trying things and different point of views, that's for sure. And as Daniel was answering, come to realize that he has more experience working on the series that is long running than I do, because I worked on 2 seasons of Counterpart, but I think that's the only time I did more than 1 season. Interestingly enough, I think, and part of it for me is I love the beginnings of things. I love the conception aspect of it.
Did you guys work on the, I called it the $8 montage, where she keeps getting $8 from all the scientists?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Can you talk to me about building something like that? Obviously there's a story point. Oh, this is how she's making money. This is how it's working. But there's got to be an accelerating rhythm to it, right? Because once you understand the point of the montage, it's got to keep getting faster and faster, I would think. Because otherwise the audience is going, yeah, I've seen this. She's gotten $8 from a bunch of people now.
Yeah.
How do you keep that interesting?
It was scripted in that one of the scientists that comes to see Elizabeth for help was singing that song. So I had to find a way to fit this song in this montage, knowing it was a montage using score. Using a different score and cutting to that song was always a problem, for instance. It never worked for me. Mathieu Barbeiro, who had started with the first 2 episodes, had used some tracks of Esquivel, this band. By luck, I found a version of the song that they did. So I used this in order to, and try to time it with the part that I thought was the best when the scientists sing to the baby, so that it would fall in this place, which made it difficult because it also meant that I had to time the acceleration around that. I had quite a lot of footage, like it was quite a lot of different versions of the same action. And what I was trying to base it on really was Brie Larson's performance. I was basing all my decision about how she had to be at the same time a working mother. And I wanted to see this through the montage. I wanted to see the tension of the two of those things. So that means like cutting to the baby occasionally and making sure we saw her taking care of the baby. At the same time, there was a lot of humor in her performance reacting to the scientist and whatever they were doing with or without the baby. In the end, we knew there was a story point of she's was going to learn that her research, her and Calvin's research, were being stolen by other scientists at the lab.
That's the way that montage ends, right? Is her realization.
Exactly. Building the montage up to a point where it feels like she's getting on top. Things are getting better, just to sweep the carpet from under her feet at the end of that.
You mentioned Bree's performance. Her performance, because she's a scientist and because of her character, she's very dry most of the time. Can you talk about either trying to maintain that or trying to regulate that, or what kind of performances she gave you so that you could say, oh, let's have her more emotional, let's have her more funny?
It was pretty clear that this is a story of how connection through the journey of life, you know, transform a person, transform the world in some way, and the people who live in that world. She is transformed by the different encounters in her life. One of the early ones we see is the one of Calvin. And if you see how she went at inhabiting Elizabeth Dodd's character, is that one, the first transformation that you notice is when she opens up to Calvin, and when Calvin opens up to her. And that gets shut down very quickly. And then it starts all over again, but this time with her daughter. She's an amazing actress, there's no doubt. And part of the attraction of working on the show was that she was gonna play Elizabeth Dodd. She's a very exact actress. She knew exactly what she wanted and where she was going. And that was really helpful, because you had those elements when we needed them, I believe. We see her coming more alive throughout the show. From the first episode to the last episode, you see the transformation of this person.
To Jerome's point, she's very exacting as an actress, deliberate with her decisions. And in the dailies, you could see that dryness and the evolution of the performance, seeing the cuts and seeing how she evolved as a character. You could see some of that brightness open up with the editing, but also in some of her, you know, acting decisions, which was kind of a joy to watch, because it's like when I first watched some of the dailies, I was like, wow, she's really dry. But at the same time, it's like, oh, this opens up into something. This is like an arc that you're seeing, but we're only seeing, you know, when we're starting on episode 3, we only see this one little chunk of how she is. And she really brought that performance and like made it come alive with like where she ends up eventually.
But it sounds like because of her precision, those were decisions she stuck pretty closely to. Some actors would give you a range that you could then choose from, but it sounds like she knew where she wanted her character to be, or the director helped her know where she wanted to be for each one of those moments throughout that arc.
There was a range. It is a project that she lived in almost more than anybody on this crew. I believe she had very specific ideas about who Elizabeth was. You have questions about the character. Is she on the spectrum? Is she not? It's maybe not the same range necessarily that in terms of a performance that you would get, but that you could modulate that in some way. She played it in a way where the element was there for you to see or not if you didn't want to, you know, you could interpret her character either way. And it works. And I think that's very interesting. There's very few characters like that, I think, on television. No, and I thought that was a very brave and interesting choice.
Just talk to me a little bit about knowing, as you're editing the earlier episodes, that you are investing in the audience some way emotionally.
One of the theme of the show is this idea of connection. This is idea of life is not a single result of a single event. It is a series of encounters, of accident, of nothing sometimes, that adds up to what an existence is and the joy of that existence. When I approach episode 8, I had very much in mind that this episode was about the connections, and it was everything that we had drawn before was going to be in some way coming to a denouement. But what was interesting is to see those storylines just that finally intersect. The one of Calvin and her mother intersect with Elizabeth and Mad, not her daughter. A lot of those things you said they needed to pay off in this last episode. Did change a little bit from the script in this episode, in subtle ways, in a way that you may not even notice, but we did change a few things in order to enhance that element of it. We worked a lot on the beginning. We worked a lot toward the end of that montage when she started reading Great Expectation in the classroom. And then we had the storyline in the middle of it. We, you know, her quitting the show, finding a new sponsor in the middle of that. We had a lot to cover, actually, in that last episode for finale, I thought. And part of it was, like you said, making sure that emotionally we would be satisfied with all the whole journey that we have seen prior to this. We had set up all those things, all the hardship. And some of those hardship continues, as a matter of fact, in the last episode. Everything is not necessarily happy ending. The strengths of the relationship that were built along the way, you had to feel that in this episode. The friendship with Harriet, the new ties with Calvin's mom. And as a matter of fact, there is a new relationship that formed in this episode between Fry and Ned Walter. I think all of this was part of what we were trying to achieve in our finale.
Talk to me about the scene, and actually any scenes that are like this, where you're trying to decide when to be on and when to be off someone talking. The specific one I'm thinking about is when Elizabeth brings her, Calvin's mom, out to the lake to see where they had their first kiss. And the two of them are having a conversation, and as an editor, of course, I'm struck by when you choose to be on Elizabeth and when you choose to be on the, Calvin's mother. How do you decide those things? When do you decide to be on Elizabeth when the mother-in-law is talking to her?
In this case, we knew that in there was a moment of decision for Elizabeth about her future. She'd made a decision, but also she was in the process of making it. What I remember thinking, especially toward the end of the scene, is that you have this moment between two women who live in different time and both try to live their lives on their own term and were not always able to do that. So there was definitely a moment when I remember this shot of Rosemary. It was interesting the way she looked at Elizabeth's character, because it felt like she was getting inspired by Elizabeth as well. And there was a moment of seeing Elizabeth's decision was also some kind of inspiration for Avery Parker. So I think I built it around that. I mean, I think this is where I wanted to sort of land in that scene. I remember that. Seeing like the bond being a bond of hope and inspiration for one another.
Earlier, you mentioned how important it was for you to spend time working on, especially that final montage when she's reading from Great Expectations. Can you talk about how scripted those flashbacks were, or that you found them, you decided which ones they were supposed to be, the timing of them, and all of that?
That was a journey. It was scripted differently. Some things were scripted, some of them were left to her suggestions, but there was also element that were shot for this montage that we didn't end up using. One of them being that we saw the new host of Superat 6.
Oh, interesting.
We realized that it's almost like we had to choose what this montage was about. In the last 2 weeks of working on this episode, there was a lot of people with me in the cutting room. I had Lee was there, Michael Costigan, Natalie Sandy, Alyssa, and Brie Larson was in the cutting room. And so many ideas were flying, too fast for me to even like take notes and for Danielle to kind of like implement them. But we did a lot of different versions. My thing about it, going back to this idea of connection, is that I intentionally didn't want to lose something or didn't want to reduce the feeling that you may have at the end of the show, which is about those connections. It is not about one specific meeting. It is not about why one person is one thing, or it is not because Elizabeth met Calvin, or because she had a daughter. It was the sum of all of those things. My worry was that the first thing you cut to, it's going to be, oh, she fell in love with Calvin, so that's why things happen the way they happen, where I was hoping to keep the possibility for the viewer that it was a sort of a organized randomness in all this. and emphasized connections, which meant that I bugged Daniel especially a lot and everybody else in the cutting room, which gives me a chance to give credit to all the other editors on the show, Matthew Barbado, who started the show and cut with his assistant as well, one episode, Jack Cunningham. Laura Zample did two episodes and also worked with our assistant, Lily Wild, on one of them. It was really like about this sense of community and this sense of how do things fit in this moment and not losing the sense of it doesn't mean something. It is about the connection. It's not about what the connection meant necessarily, which comes to me asking everybody to come see different version of this montage constantly to see where I was at. Going back to episodes and picking moments out of everybody else's work where I thought it would illustrate or bring you an emotion rather than, you know, using images for what the emotion they produce rather than for the information of the image itself. And yeah, for me, this montage is really, it's a little sentimental for me because it's a little bit of everybody in there. In the show, everybody's work he's in that montage, and I'm very sort of proud that everybody is in there. Another thing that is in there is that once we cut out the montage and we show Elizabeth bringing the lasagna, and there's a table which is supposed to be a potluck dinner with everybody. And I remember asking everyone, okay, what do you think we can have on the table before they shot it? I remembered the rib from my own episode 4. And then Laura Zample tell me, oh, what about the deviled eggs, with paprika, that she leaves for Mad when she starts working on Sopranistic. So even on that nobody knows, but I do, is like everybody is on the table too.
So the editors had some input into even the production design of that shot.
Yes, I wasn't really asked, but Tara is so nice. And Tara Mill is such a great director, and she was so collaborative and so inviting of ideas that here we are.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that maybe you wouldn't have done that with another director, but with this director.
You know, when you don't know someone very well, it's always difficult to know. You don't want to overstep. And also, especially sound like, yeah, it's not necessarily my place to say those things. This is not my first interaction with Tara. It was after many interactions with her that I could maybe suggest something.
And what's kind of awesome about that sequence was that there is a version of that. We have Elizabeth reading from the book, and then we see like where everybody's at. Like maybe like Harriet's a lawyer, maybe, you know, Elizabeth's in the classroom, like kind of a montage like that. But instead, it's like these emotional beats of like how each character has like reverberated throughout each other's lives. What's also really nice about that is that food creates that interconnectedness, you know? So as Elizabeth's cooking, she's like creating these like connections for other people, the people around her that she's like met. And at that dinner table, it's like, here's everybody that she wouldn't have met if she hadn't met Calvin. And the way Dro chose those pieces and assembled that sequence, that it makes it all the more powerful. It's like way more powerful than if it was like kind of, you know, the standard kind of montage, like, okay, let's wrap everything up. You know, like, let's see the new host of Supper at Six. Let's see, you know, Elizabeth doing more chemistry teaching and stuff. Cause that's, you know, that would have its own sort of impact, but it's not as emotional. And like, I feel like as a viewer, you don't connect.
But we had to go through our own journey in order to get there, which makes the memory of it more meaningful to me. We had to start somewhere, which all was part of the process, and in the learning, and is part of the process and growing from, you know, one version to the other.
Daniel, you kind of smiled the first time that Giroux said, oh, that montage was a journey. You were like, oh, yeah.
I mean, it was an awesome journey as well. Is what it is. And sometimes it's all about the journey, not necessarily the destination. I come from music. I'm a musician. And part of how I got into this was through music and writing. And when I the first thing I ever cut felt like I was getting the same kind of like musical high I would when I like write a song or something like that. And it's a lot like sculpting too, in that way, where it's like you have these pieces, you have this chunk of clay that's like your footage, and you're just kind of like pulling pieces away. It's like, okay, is this what it's going to look like? Is this what it's going to look like? There's so many different ways you can sculpt the face or, you know, the human body or whatever. So that's kind of how I always like view it. And maybe that's me being a little, you know, too artistic or something, like thinking of it in that way. So how I approach stuff is how I've always approach creative things, which is, you know, you kind of try something, and if it doesn't work, you kind of try it and it'll feel right, you know, and then you can start to think about it a little bit more and like get a kind of an intellectual way, like how Giroux approaches stuff, which I've learned a lot from him regarding that aspect.
I noticed in some of the early scenes, jump cuts. Did you watch other editors' scenes and know, okay, now this is part of the language of the series, is especially during cooking, I can do jump cuts, or for the big montage at the end, what great moments are there that I can pull from? Did you talk to the other editors, or did you just watch the episodes and know that was the footage that you had?
It depended a little bit of where everybody was in the process. Meaning, like when I started, and when we started, sorry, Matthew was deep into cutting episode 1 and 2. The three of us had, at some point, Laura, Matthew, and I had to cut 2 episodes in a row. And Matthew had the task of doing the first episode, which was setting up a lot. But when I started, he was in the process of doing this. I watched his episode knowing that things were still shifting. And I don't even remember if those sort of quick flashback of Elizabeth were, I do not believe, were in the first version that I saw. That being said, my first episode was the one in 6:30, Elizabeth's dog's point of view, which was such a turn from the other episode that he had to find his own language as well. So in this case, obviously we talked with Matthew, but we did not interact that much at the beginning. As we went along and Laura came on, and we were all also in the office, it's also that helps the communication and the collaboration. When we were geographically in the same place, a lot more of that happened. And suddenly with the last 2 episodes, so Matthew did episode 7 and I did it, and Daniel and I did episode 8. There's a scene from our episode that moved into Matthew's, and we had to borrow a lot from Matthew's episode to work on the beginning of the finale with the whole storyline with Calvin as a child. In that case, we got to know each other pretty well by the end. It was strong friendships.
What scene moved from one episode to another?
The scene when Wakely brought the letters that Calvin wrote to him, when he brought them to Matt, used to be at the beginning of episode 108. And I believe it was Brie Larson's note saying that it felt like we already were beyond that moment when we started episode 8. And we did need that moment. So to Matthew's credit, he managed to make it fit so well in episode 7. It was interesting because we had to use more element of Calvin's in the boys' home, making it feel the same that what we've seen in 107, but still slightly from a different point of view. So it meant like reusing, sometimes making sure we use the same shot and sometimes using enough of different coverage to make you feel you didn't actually experience things quite in the same way.
Were there any scenes that you guys had to cut? And what was the creative reasoning about cutting the scene, or was it just time?
2 scenes we cut.
The one that I worked on that was cut entirely, not moved anywhere else, was after the courtroom scene, after Harriet's loss. There was a scene outside of the courtroom where she's just so devastated and so wrought with the loss. It's a really nice beat with the family. I wasn't privy to why it was completely excised from the cut, but I think we wanted to keep the emotion probably with her and Elizabeth.
The beat was not unlike the following beat, which had happened with Elizabeth. That's what was happening.
It was a double beat.
Mostly.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking when you were saying that, was that it was a double beat. What about the second scene?
Elizabeth's decision process of finding a new sponsor and quitting the show. There was a scene to illustrate that process where after the Christmas party, she was coming back home and opening boxes and finding Calvin's old notebooks with science in it. And part of it was that I think in the way they thought it was first thought about is a reason to quit the show and going back to science was science. Her daughter suggested that she should be back in the lab, and then that planted possibly the idea, which was never really gone, but that revived the ideas of, you know, science as a career. And then it was sort of, there was that scene that was making it clear what it was. I felt like it was not so clear why. And also what I thought was more powerful is that it was a daughter who had suggested it was not science itself. The bond to science was linked to the bond of life, all of it together. We worked on a version of the scene with Christmas party, and we had to rig things differently to land in a way that one of the last things you see is her looking at our daughter and our Charlie's Jr. playing, so that even you know that the wheels are turning in the head, you don't necessarily know what's going on, but it's trying, this attempting to tie that to her seeing the future of a daughter and also moving forward. It's not about going back to what she's done before. It's about moving forward and evolving from where we came from. Hopefully it succeeds in some level, but I think it was suggesting that without spelling it out was clearer in some way. So for the moment of her showing up with the new sponsor, which is Tampax.
I love the idea of that, that the emotion is more important, that that you feel that the daughter is the reason for the choice, not because of, like you said, the science. I do have one final question, because this is an awards show. It's nominated. Congratulations to both of you. What do you look at when you're judging? What triggers your decision to vote for another show when you're watching it?
So when I watch something, I'll usually I kind of take it in. How did it make me feel, like, in the moment? Like, what are my thoughts? Like, how am I still thinking about it days later? That's like kind of usually a good barometer for myself. Yeah. So it's always, what was like the visceral impact? Does it create something new in my mind that I'm like, oh, wow, I've never really seen that before?
I find it very difficult as well to judge the editing itself, because there's a lot of it that us as an audience do not know what the journey has been for a colleague. So it's, some of it may be more obvious than others. There is no good experience of watching anything if there is not a great editing involved. Yeah, after that, there's almost a personal touch to it, where whatever lingers for me for days or doesn't leave my memory, I would definitely start giving high marks. It's a difficult question to answer, but the unseen is as important as what you see.
That's a great place to end this conversation. Daniel and Jeroz, thank you so much for being on Art of the Cut. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I really enjoyed your episode and the whole series.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Jero Brisson, ACE, and Daniel Martins for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.